This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for online success that helps you build the perfect website to make your business stand out. Whether you're starting a passion project or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy for you to create beautiful websites, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place on your terms. Unless you're a pro coding design wizard, and confession time, I'm very much not, making a quality, good-looking website can feel like one of the hardest bits of business. That's why Squarespace is here to help you every step of the way, providing fully customizable professional layouts and templates to choose from. It can also take care of those fiddly bits like device optimization, paywalls, and invoicing. So if, like me, you're more at home with manuscripts than JavaScript, Squarespace is the tool for you. Head to squarespace.com/history10 for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code history10, that's history10, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Please be aware that this episode includes a description of historical antisemitism. It's a beautiful spring morning beside the coast in North Wales. Gulls wheel and screech, and the waves lap gently against the shoreline. The crystal clear water of the estuary reflects the snow-capped mountains nearby. But the hundreds of builders don't have time to enjoy the view. Scaffolders clamber up wooden ladders, yelling greetings to each other as they scamper up the side of a half-built tower. They have work to do. They're working on a brand new castle. It's an enormous job. Pairs of masons drag long, sharp-toothed saws back and forth over chunks of stone, carving blocks. Carpenters bash nails into wooden floors. A blacksmith hammers away at his forge, fixing tools and making new nails as fast as the other men can use them. Then, from within the tower, comes a long, low moan. Something, or someone, is in agony. The hammering and sawing stops, and the builders listen as the moan crescendos, then dies away again. They get back to work, but a minute or so later, there it is again. It's a deep, primal groan. Once more, the men stop their work. Some of them feel almost guilty to be hearing it, as though they're intruding just by being at work today. But no one goes to investigate. All the builders here know exactly what that noise is, and what it means. Inside the tower, Eleanor of Castile, Queen of England, lies with a team of women bustling around her as she moans. Though it's late April, they have a fire blazing in the newly built grate, which sends up wood smoke into air already thick with masonry dust. Queen Eleanor is giving birth, and her baby is due at any moment now. The women are experienced midwives. They've all done this many times before. So has Eleanor. The baby she's labouring is her 15th, or is it 16th? She's 42 years old, and she's been pregnant for so much of her life that everyone has lost count. Only 6 of her children have survived. 5 girls, called Eleanor, Joan, Margaret, Mary, and Elizabeth, and a boy called Alfonso. But none of them was born quite like this, in the middle of a building site, hundreds of miles from the English capital, in North Wales, almost as far west as you can go in the British mainland without falling into the Irish Sea. This is no accident, though. In April 1284, Eleanor has been dragged here to this coastal Welsh town of Carnarvon to give birth as part of a grand political project cooked up by her husband, the Plantagenet King, Edward I. After the humiliating disasters of his dad Henry III's reign, Edward has been selling himself as a new King Arthur. And that's about far more than cosplaying ye olde Knights of the Round Table. Edward's vision of becoming Arthur means bringing the whole of Britain under his command, rather than just England. He started that project in Wales. As we heard last episode, Edward sent vast armies trundling into Wales, fighting bloody battles and killing the great Welsh king Llywelyn ap Gruffydd, whose head ended up on a spike above the Tower of London. For good measure, Edward has also captured and killed Llywelyn's brother Dafydd, and tried out a hideous new type of execution on him – hanging, drawing and quartering. More on that, along with all the ins and outs of castle building, in this week's subscriber episode. But Edward hasn't stopped there. He doesn't just want to kill and chop up Welsh princes, he wants to make one of his own. Which is why Eleanor is here, in one of the most fiercely independent parts of Wales. The child she's bearing here, a boy as luck would have it, is going to grow up with "born in Wales" stamped on his passport. He'll be known as Edward of Carnarvon, and, in his dad King Edward's mind at any rate, that'll make him the ultimate cuckoo in the nest. He'll be a Welshman, but one whose job is going to be to stamp out Welsh independence forever. It's a sort of evil genius in its way. But it's also only half the story. There's another reason that Eleanor is giving birth to this young prince on the building site of a castle, rather than somewhere more comfortable, sanitary or quiet. Edward knows that just sending his wife up to Wales to pop out a sprog isn't a fully realised strategy for colonising a proudly independent people who've seen off invasions by the Romans, Saxons, Vikings and Normans. To conquer the Welsh, Edward has decided to build a network of fortresses unlike any seen in Britain before. Carnarvon is one of more than a dozen gigantic stone behemoths which he's throwing up across Wales. They're influenced by the latest architectural designs Edward saw when he was out on crusade. There are castles on the go in Conwy, Harlech, Beaumaris, Aberystwyth, Flint and Rhuthlon. And now at Carnarvon, arguably the jewel in the crown, one of these fortresses can claim to be the birthplace of a new Welsh prince. So as Eleanor pushes and groans her way to the end of her labour, and the builders swarming over Carnarvon saw, hammer, lever, dig and bash, Edward I's vision of a new Plantagenet Age of Arthur is coming a big step closer to reality. There's just one problem. Making babies is free. Building castles is wildly, teeth-shatteringly expensive. Edward wants to be King Arthur, but footing the bill is going to lead him into one of the darkest episodes in British history. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 9, Blood Money. When Henry III chose his royal advisers, he ended up with some very untrustworthy power grabbers, which led to poor management decisions, rebellions, and at least one person in prison. Why didn't he use Indeed? Well, Indeed wasn't around back then, but it is today. Indeed is the ultimate hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and matching technology that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. When I was hiring, I didn't use Indeed either, and the process was very slow and stressful, so I wish I had. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/dynasty. Indeed.com/dynasty. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. If anyone ever asks, what did the Plantagenets ever do for us? There are two answers. The first is the worthy intellectual one. Magna Carta, the origins of Parliament, the English legal system, the separation of cultures between England and France, that sort of thing. But the more exciting way to answer the question is to spend half a day wandering around one of the great buildings that the Plantagenets have left us. In this season, we've already spoken about Henry III rebuilding Westminster Abbey as a new mausoleum for English royalty. But I reckon Edward I's castles in North Wales are every bit as awe-inspiring a demonstration of Plantagenet power echoing down the ages, still tangible to us today. Carnarvon Castle is a case in point. The first time you go there, it blows your socks off. Then it does the same, the second, third, and fourth times too. What I'm saying is, you need a lot of socks. It juts out onto the seafront, dominating the town around. The thick walls have beautiful bands of multicoloured stone built into them, designed to evoke the walls of the Roman capital of Constantinople. The octagonal towers built into the walls are elegant as well as menacing. It has a high-security gatehouse, where unwelcome visitors can be attacked in any number of painful and inventive ways. And there are little in-jokes built into the architecture. The towers at one end deliberately look like the coat of arms of Castile, the Spanish kingdom where his beloved wife Eleanor was born. This isn't just a place that Edward built to put the fear of God, and him, into the people of the area. It's a place that's full of Plantagenet lore and family myth, a monument to this mad, bad, and very entertaining to know dynasty. Anyway, that's enough free advertising for the Carnarvon Tourist Board. Let's get back to the 1280s, when Edward is building this castle, and many others, in his bid to become a new King Arthur. It's an ambitious and visionary project, no doubt. It'll leave deep scars on the Welsh landscape, and Welsh cultural memories too. It also produces one of the craziest Plantagenets we've met, in the form of little Edward of Carnarvon. But no spoilers on him just yet. In the immediate context of the 1280s, King Edward's castle-building spree, as well as the military campaigns that precede it, put pressure on him to raise money. Stacks of it. The costs run somewhere close to £150,000. It's hard to convert that into modern money, but suffice to say it's several times the Plantagenet crown's entire annual income. If the UK government spent money on that scale today, it would be like pumping about £3 trillion into a single policy. Some of that dough can be raised from tax, though since Henry III's reign, that has to be negotiated with Parliament, which can be a sticky process. Some can be borrowed from the church, barons and professional moneylenders, including Italian bankers and England's Jewish population. Plenty can be stolen or confiscated, depending on your point of view, from the Welsh. All the same, Edward has a mighty task on his hands working out how to pay for his ambitions in Wales, as well as other areas of concern like Gascony, where he still has French territories to defend. To try and get a handle on his very precarious financial situation, Edward realises he has to roll up his sleeves and get stuck into a full-blown programme of reform. After his dad's dire reign, that's long overdue anyway. But if he gets it right, he figures it could help him find new ways to pay for his shopping list of castles, armies, and all things Arthurian. Edward's reforms in England are put into place with a flurry of statutes. These are largely directed with the help of his Chancellor, that's effectively his Prime Minister, a bishop from Shropshire called Robert Burnell. He's about the same age as Edward, and they go way, way back. Edward knows Robert's a safe pair of hands, and he's trusted him with all sorts of previous business, like looking after his lands when Edward and Eleanor went to the East on crusade. The big idea that underpins Edward and Robert Burnell's drive to reform Plantagenet government is this. They know that Magna Carta ties the government's hands in terms of arbitrarily demanding money from barons. They also know that they're now obliged to go to parliaments to get tax. But they have a feeling that there are lots of folk in England getting stinking rich on income from lands and offices they claim to have been granted by kings in times gone by, not least in Henry III's reign, when the taps of royal generosity were on full blast. They're also pretty darn sure there's a huge amount of financial leakage in the system, with corrupt, lazy or incompetent people in local government, alongside general inefficiency. And they understand a basic truth of statecraft in almost any age of human history. People don't like giving their money to the government. If Edward wants to tap into his subjects' wealth, he and Robert Burnell need to show that they're giving good value for money. To combat all of that, they start up a programme of reform that targets all three of these issues. Burnell sends out teams of investigators into the shires of England to find out what's going on with local officials and royal finances, so they can claw back any money owed to the Treasury and get rid of any duffers and crooks who are getting rich through royal jobs. They completely overhaul the way that debts to the Crown are chased up. They carry out what's basically a national census, known as the Hundred Roll Inquiries, to make sure that everyone who should pay tax is paying. They make heavy use of a legal process known as quoeronto. It's Latin for by whose authority, but basically means prove it. Anyone getting money from the Treasury needs to provide the relevant legal document or lose the income. To make sure this doesn't start a full-blown meltdown, Edward and Burnell also pass laws that are designed to be people-pleasers. The coinage is in a shabby state, so they order a full restoration, melting down all the existing coins in circulation, issuing shiny new ones with a stable value, and hanging people they accuse of forging coins. They make a great show of being tough on crime, with a new statute which says that if local communities shield criminals from facing justice, then the whole community will get fined and collectively punished. They make simple but brilliant changes, like an anti-highwayman law, which orders all the hedges and ditches between main roads joining trading towns to be cut back, so that, as the law puts it, no one can hide near the road with evil intent. In short, Edward and Robert go hell for leather on tightening up their purse strings and the rulebook. To an extent, it works. Ordinary people will still be talking about Edward's laws as the gold standard of Plantagenet rule generations later. But with all the castles Edward wants to build, and the cost of wars, which goes up and up as his reign goes on, it's still not enough. So in 1290, Edward decides he needs to do something drastic. He decides to target a wealthy group of his subjects who he can plunder for everything they've got without any blowback. It's a terrible policy that's a stain on his name to this day. And it all starts with a near-death experience. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. The very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. On Easter Sunday 1287, Edward is hosting a party in Bordeaux, the capital city of the English Duchy of Gascony. It's the most important day in the Christian calendar. And for anyone who's anyone in Plantagenet Gascony, this is the place to be. Edward has taken over the top room of a large tower in the city, and it's packed with his friends, nobles, knights, and hangers-on. As the party gets going, outside, the skies start to darken. Somewhere in the distance, thunder rolls. No one pays it too much attention. It's only a storm after all. Nobody listens either to another ominous sound, a sort of wooden creaking, which seems to come from somewhere below them. By the time the party is really jumping, the creak from inside the tower gets louder and louder. Soon it's not just a creaking, but a sort of wrenching, tearing sound. And then, with a horrifying ease, the floor beneath the feet of the revelers just disappears. 1 minute it's there, the next there's no floor at all, and the dozens of partygoers are falling down and down and down. One of them later remembers that as they tumble, through a window they see a flash of lightning. For some of them, that's the last thing they ever see. With a terrible smash and rumble of collapsing timber and masonry, the whole party crash through every floor of the tower, falling around 80 feet to the ground, where the debris from the collapse of the tower rains down on them. Some are crushed and instantly killed. Others lie screaming under the rubble. Yet there are a lucky few who stand up, dust themselves off, and walk out of the tower virtually unscathed, unable to believe what's just happened. Edward is one of those. He's fallen through the building like everyone else. But he stumbles to his feet to find he's only broken his collarbone. Yes, it hurts like hell, but it's hardly life-threatening. This feels like a sign. No one has any right to survive that kind of fall. God must have saved him for a reason. Getting his head around what God is trying to tell him will lead Edward and England down a dark path. The effects of this accident in Bordeaux will reverberate throughout centuries of British history. But what's Edward doing in Bordeaux in the first place? The previous year, in spring 1286, Edward, Queen Eleanor, and a huge entourage from the English nobility boarded a massive fleet of ships and set sail to France. First, they headed to Paris. There, the French King Philip III had just died, leaving his 18-year-old son, Philip IV, to take over. This Philip, known as Philip the Fair, will turn out to be a real piece of work, although you wouldn't know it on first sight. He's very handsome, but so shy he barely says a word. He's compared by one French bishop to a useless owl, who can do nothing but stare at people. This gets Philip all wrong, as time will tell. In fact, watch this space for an exciting announcement about this coming soon. But owl or not, in 1286, Edward had to go and get his formal blessing to hold on to Gascony. He also fancied doing some European statesmanship and persuading this new French king to squash an ongoing beef with the Kingdom of Aragon. And Edward being a Plantagenet, he's been making vague plans to go on another crusade. This felt like a good chance to whip up some support for that too. So, having done his duty in Paris, Edward came down to Gascony, planning to give the government there a good spring clean. Which is how we found him, throwing a party in Bordeaux at Easter 1287. But his near-death experience switches up his priorities. As he recovers from his broken collarbone, Edward decides that the top item on his agenda should be doing God's work. That means throwing himself into the new crusade, getting sign-off from the Pope, negotiating with the Mongols to see if they want to collaborate on attacking the Mamluks, that sort of thing. Most of all, it means raising money, which is a problem. What with all his Welsh castles, Edward already has a crazy list of monthly outgoings. And despite all the work he and Robert Burnell have done, he still spends more than he earns. Crusades are big-ticket items. Taxes can be raised for them, but they're unpopular. What's a king to do? That's where Edward gets another brainwave. He realises there's a way to raise money for his crusade and all those castles, while also doing what he sees as God's work. He decides to take aim at Gascony's Jewish population. He's going to expel all the Jewish people from the province, take over their debts, and more or less steal from them everything they own. In the 13th century, this is depressingly commonplace. Other rulers have been pulling the same trick for years. Jews have been driven out of France and Brittany already. Individual lords and ladies, including the late Simon de Montfort and Edward's mother, Eleanor of Provence, have ejected Jews from their own lands. Edward has already been making anti-Jewish policy part of his populist pitch in England. He's banned Jewish moneylending in response to complaints from barons who hate paying interest on loans or losing their estates when they default on debts. He's forced Jews to wear yellow badges, to attend sermons by Christian preachers, and to shut down most of their synagogues. He's hanged some Jews as scapegoats for widespread coin forgery. Despite, or because of this, there's still a strong mood of anti-Semitism in England and Gascony. Now Edward reckons he can turn a tidy profit on it. So it is that in 1287, Edward expels all the Jews from Gascony. Then, when he goes back to England, he does the same thing there, passing a law called the Edict of Expulsion. This gives Jewish people just over 3 months to get out of the country or be sentenced to death. It's a horrendous and, needless to say, grotesquely bigoted piece of legislation. The Jewish population in England is tiny, some 2,000 people out of a population creeping towards 6 million. But they're now hounded out of the country with nothing more than the possessions they can carry. Some Jews are deliberately abused and even killed as they try to leave. One account tells of a group of Jews from London who hire a Christian captain to take them out of the country. The captain tricks them into wandering on a sandbank in the tidal estuary of the Thames, and they all drown. That's just one horrific story from one of the worst episodes in Plantagenet history. And the repercussions live way beyond the Middle Ages. Edward expels the Jews in 1290. It's not until 1656 that Jewish people are readmitted to the country, and prejudice and discrimination lasts long beyond that, as recent history makes all too plain. Does Edward I care about any of that? Sorry to say, he does not. Rampant anti-Semitism is the order of the day in late 13th century England. As well as confiscating Jewish property, Edward uses the Edict of Expulsion to secure a massive tax from Parliament. It raises him more than £100,000, more than enough to pay for his new crusade. Except, Edward doesn't go on crusade. Because, as he's planning how to get to the Holy Land, someone else sets off on a journey that will change the course of Plantagenet history forever. That someone is a 6-year-old girl, who in 1290 gets in a boat from the southwestern coast of Norway, heading towards Scotland. On her tiny shoulders rests the future of two great nations. But that's for next time, on This Is History.